and children, and let them come quickly. For a voice of crying is heard out of Zion, for we are greatly confused. For death has come into our ghettos to cut off the young men and women from the streets of Philadelphia, New York, L.A., Georgia, Ohio, Florida, Mississippi, and throughout America, South America, the Caribbean islands, Africa, Asia, and all over the world. So return unto me, thus saith Yah, and I will return unto you, O my people.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and listen to the program from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and listen to the live stream from there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. That's in the black belt. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can listen to the program and stream it live, even into your car if you have Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, it's time for an Awakening Radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. And that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening Radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening Radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media. The homepage is there also, with chock full of plenty of new content. Podcasts of the different programs are being added daily. And also new things is coming down the pipe this month. So check it out. Make that one of your favorites. If it's not, put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, scheduled to have a special guest join us, and we're happy to have her. PhD candidate for English, writer, educator, and advocate, and activist, Sarah L. Webb will be joining us this evening. The topic, The Roots and Routes of Colorism. We'll be going into this extremely important topic when we come back after a brief word from our sponsor.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. After the brief storm we had, or wind blowing, it kept me in, Elliot. I wasn't going to fly away, so I just stayed in the house and heard it whistle.
Yeah, well, it kept me out for a little while because my power went out, so I didn't have any heat, lights, or anything. I had to go somewhere else. I couldn't stay in this house. It was ice cold in here. So, but I'm back in here now, so I'm kind of moving and grooving again.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to our discussion tonight. Sister Webb, Sarah Webb, it comes up often, so it's something where we can have someone help us kind of unpack this whole issue around, or this whole reality around colorism.
You know, it does come up often, and I can't wait to talk to our guest this evening, Ms. Webb. Because, Richard, it's almost like the elephant in the room. It comes up, but our people don't want to talk about it. It's a strange phenomenon, so to speak. And sometimes when it comes up in negative conversations. I don't think it comes up where we can talk about it. And in fact, it came up on this program about 3, maybe 4 weeks ago. You know, where it kind of deteriorated slightly. But I don't think that our people really talk about this in the vein that it should be talked about from a historical perspective and looking at it and see where we need to go in the future in relation to this. Hopefully our guest tonight, Ms. Sarah L. Webb, a PhD candidate at LSU University, writer, educator, advocate, and activist. She founded the website Colorism Healing and has written many articles, published books. Is a professional writer, teacher, and a mentor since 2007, working in a range of industries with universities, nonprofits, K-12 public education. Her works have been published in numerous places, online, in print books, and in magazines. Welcome to the program, Sister Sarah Webb is with us this evening. Ms. Webb, how are you?
Hear me fine?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Great. I'm happy to have you with us. After a couple weeks of kind of missing one another, you're finally here.
Yes. And I'm glad to be here.
Ms. Webb, let me open the conversation, and my co-host is going to be jumping in, Brother Richard. This is a interesting topic. It's interesting to the point where it comes up a lot of times in conversation among our people, but it's almost like the elephant in the room. It's really strange to describe, because whenever we talk about it, it's never talked about in the perspective that it needs to be talked about. And when I ran across your work, because me and Brother Richard have been talking about trying to get somebody on to talk about this from a perspective that we need to kind of look at it from, and I ran across your work and thought that you would be a good person to bring on to talk about this issue.
Great.
And I want you to take it from here. Well, before I introduce it, because I want to read something that you quoted in one of your articles to start the conversation. But before we go there, just tell me what started you to not only put together the website Colorism Healing, but to kind of go out and try to get to the bottom of this, to talk with people, to to really put this out there? What started you on that path?
Great question. So I am a dark-skinned black woman living in the United States, and I come from a family like many African-American families that has people of all shades, from very, very light to very, very dark. And my mom actually tells a story, because I have a sister who's several shades lighter than me, and my mom tells a story about how a relative was talking about how beautiful she was and things like that, and my mom overheard me say, you know, that's because she's light-skinned. And then just growing up, I've had bullies. I would watch TV. I would look at magazines and not see women who look like me. So I had a very personal experience with it. But like you said, it's an elephant in the room that's kind of taboo. That is something that we all recognize and see, but that I always felt I could not express openly and have conversations with other people about. But then I became a high school teacher. And you love your students. You want to see them grow and flourish. I was kind of surprised and disappointed and hurt to see that colorism was still very much embedded in a younger generation.
Yes.
And to hear my students say things like, I'm less proud of myself because I got dark over the summer, or I don't look pretty in this picture because I look black, right? And so that kind of broke my heart. And I realized at that point that it was bigger than just the things I had experienced. So I wanted to use what I had, which was writing at the time. I am a writer. I teach writing, to kind of do something about it, right? And so I said, well, it's not enough just for me to become okay with it. Like, I can't just sit by and let colorism continue to infect generations to come. So in my own way, I wanted to get the word out. And there have been people researching colorism for decades, right? But there wasn't, at the time in 2013, there wasn't a whole lot online. A lot of the articles and stuff that had been published were academic or scholarly books that, you know, a 14-year-old or, you know, just regular everyday people might not have access to. So the website and the writing contest and me publishing books of poetry and stuff like that was to, again, bring the conversation to as broad of an audience as possible.
Ms. Webb, I want to introduce the conversation like this, and I want to read a quote from one of your articles, The Roots and Routes of Colorism.
Okay.
You state that some might think that explaining the origins of colorism in America is as simple as pointing to slavery, but it's deeper than that. Colorism is the result of white supremacy ideology, which is ancient compared to slavery in America. Now, I want you to kind of give the background on it. I want to focus on our experience here, because I think our experience with it here kind of took on a new life dealing with this particular topic. But go into that from your comments here.
So I think one of the reasons why slavery was able to exist is because there was already a belief among part of the world that people descending from Africa were subhuman, right? Were less human. And I think there are regional variances to a lot of this history. So I know we're focusing on the African-American experience, or, you know, blacks in the U.S., but the notion that whiteness or that European ancestry, right, or that lighter skin was superior and across the board is something that has existed in many cultures around the globe.
Okay.
And what you're saying about how slavery, though, in the U.S. in particular, it did take on a whole new life. And that's because the concept of race, right? We all say race is a social construct, with the one-drop rule of the United States, with the particular ways that slavery existed in the United States, even different from other countries that had slavery, right? So other countries that had slavery had a looser system of racial classifications in the United States, which affects the way that colorism shows up in those different places. So that's kind of what I was talking about, thinking about it from a global perspective. But if you're talking about in the U.S., then definitely understanding slavery is at the heart of understanding colorism in the U.S. context.
You know, going back, just recalling some of that that particular article, you mm-hmm. talk about how colorism have been injected into the Bible as it's constructed, mm-hmm. and especially as it had been constructed after the councils of Nicaea, when different things were added in reference to the color and pigmentation of people of the Bible, ancient scriptures. And that has mm-hmm. definitely influenced how Europeans see black folks, and also, hold on 1 second, how Europeans see black folks and how they have developed this global ideology of white supremacy. You kind of touched on that in your article when you talk about the curse of Ham and things of that nature, and
right.
how these things spread abroad before it even got here to mm-hmm. 1619, and how they interacted with our ancestors.
Right.
The way it was done here, you had a lot of our ancestors on plantations, and European slave masters would have sex with the women, with young girls. Mm-hmm. In fact, it would start very early because mm-hmm. they wanted them to have a certain amount of children by the age of 20.
Right.
When these children came along, talk about how, see, because that really, and it's hard to put it into words because
mm-hmm.
this stuff was started early on,
yes.
but it has taken on a new life hundreds of years later, just among our people. It, mm-hmm. it really has to be dealt with, but we have to look at it from a historical perspective, as you was pointing out in several of your articles.
Yes.
Talk about how this tore apart the fabric of black families by the introduction of mixed race children early on.
Yes. So I want to emphasize the fact that a lot of mixed race children were the product of rape.
Yes.
Like this was not in most cases consensual for black women who were enslaved.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the pain, right? I think that's why some of this history is so painful, is because it was so abusive and so dehumanizing. But again, because of the one-drop rule, anyone who had an African or black or Negro parent, the terminology has changed over the years, would be considered black. But when you think about how racism was originally conceived, it was based on how you look, right? So then all of a sudden you have people who look very, very different. People who have all different types of hair textures and skin tones and eye colors and the nose, their noses are shaped differently, their lips are shaped differently. And yet the system is still going to classify them as black, right? So then the idea of racism in America starts to collapse under the weight of itself. Because all of a sudden you have people who look white, but on paper they're still classified as black. In terms of when a slave master would father a child, they would be slaves, right? And that was to perpetuate the system of slavery in and of itself. I think you alluded to that. So as long as the child took the condition of the mother, then white men could rape black women. And if children were a result, then they kind of increased their own quote-unquote property, right?
Okay.
Then that was a way for them to expand their wealth. And it also ensured that their wealth would stay in the family, right, amongst the white family, and not be distributed to people of African descent. That being said, a lot of people saw mixed race slaves as more human because of their European ancestry, right? So it's not that light skin in and of itself was seen as superior. It's that light skin represented European ancestry, which then made you superior, right?
Okay.
So it's the fact that you had some white blood in you that made white society say, okay, well, you're different from other Negroes, right? You're different from other blacks because you have some whiteness in you. So they, you know, they perceive them to be more intelligent. They perceive them to be able to do more nuanced kinds of work. And that's where the so-called house slaves and field slaves came from. They felt like the disposition of mulatto or mixed race or quadroon slaves was more civilized than people who were not mixed. And so they would be allowed to do other types of service work. A lot of times they were taught trades, in some cases given education or like sent off to schools, especially in the New Orleans Creole area, right?
Okay.
And that, I think that has led to then systemic issues beyond slavery, right? So if people descended from mulatto slaves or mixed race slaves who had some education, right, or who had some refined trades or skills, then post-slavery, that benefited them throughout society, right? Or even if they were given their freedom, right, after their white parent died, right? All those things contributed then to a generational legacy of elevated status for other people who descended from mixed race slaves.
Okay.
And then obviously, you know, we're talking about general patterns, right? So I'm not saying that there weren't any dark-skinned, non-mixed slaves who didn't learn any trades or didn't, you know, work in the house. Usually if a dark-skinned slave was working in the house, they were either a young child or a much older person who couldn't work in the field, if that makes sense. So yeah, I'll stop there and see if you have any questions for clarification or want me to focus in on one part more or not.
Richard, jump into the conversation.
Yeah, you know, thank you, Sister Webb, if you don't mind me saying, for you helping us develop this. Now, if I may, can we, you know, this thing of the historical origin, I think is important for us to really kind of go over when we're talking about today and maybe, you know, problem resolution, because as you say, we're looking at a period when Eurasians, Europeans, they started to create a classification, and that's through Europe and through Christianity or Islam. But before that, you know, it's told to us that the ancient Greeks, particularly, they idealized the African dark skin image. So it's a flip, and I'm wondering, would you agree that that flip comes because later on, Eurasians, Europeans wanted to dominate, as you said earlier, and control for labor purposes African people, and that's where creating these ideals, which are so anciently rooted, comes in at.
Yes, so I think that's a good point. Thank you for bringing that up. I definitely agree. I think there are two ways to respond to people who we see as radically different from ourselves. So you think about the way cultures interacted in ancient times, right? You would imagine you travel, you get into a ship, or you walk long distances, and you come across a culture of people who is radically different from where you come from. You could do two things. You could either worship those people as gods and like, oh my gosh, you're so different, you must be superior, or you must be a divine being. Or you could have the very opposite reaction and say, oh my goodness, you're so different, you must be subhuman, you must be something vile or evil, right? A lot of times that's how people react to difference. So I think when you talk about the ancient cultures that kind of worshiped Africans or people with dark skin, I think it's still like a fetish, or like still not recognizing that at the end of the day there's humanity there. And then when you have a scarcity mindset, which a lot of Western cultures think in binary terms. They think in terms of limited resources. They think in terms of like hoarding power and wealth and resources. And so then it does become important to very clearly establish boundaries between us and them. And one of the clearest ways to do that, right, was to say, okay, well, these people look so different, so it's easy to identify them as not being us. And there, you know, you think about the queens and the kings who ruled Europe throughout the years, who would put out propaganda saying, we don't want, you know, these Moors or these dark-skinned people coming into our land and using up our resources. You know, it's very much like the rhetoric that still exists about immigrant populations, especially from black and brown countries, right? where it's like, oh, we have limited resources here and we want to maintain our way of life, so we reject those other people. And so, yeah, definitely when Europe was trying to expand its empire, it had to then also sell the belief that they deserved to rule, right? It had to convince itself that Europeans have to convince themselves that they deserve to rule over others. And then they also tried very hard, and sometimes successfully, more successfully than others, convinced the people that they were then colonizing or trying to control. So, yeah, I agree with that, that in order to get power in the way that European countries did, it did require also brainwashing people, in a sense, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, and that gets because in preparing, I was thinking, you know, of Dr. Amos Wilson's Falsification of African Consciousness, and he uses this, he kind of said this thing about labeling as social control. And the reason why I think it's important is the point that where we are now when we're talking about colorism and how we are, because what I pick up is a lot of, in my family and with me, the individual experience of what's the one clip I seen in your blog where it was a movie and what did he say? He said I'm brainwashed, but it's a term where you recognize that you have a inclination towards, in this case, light skinned women. So the social control mechanisms that we have. Is that so? Is in your experience and what you have gathered, is there a lot of you've noticed that people are dealing with the personalized experience of colorism, and that's what we're always addressing, our individual experience?
That is a very significant aspect of this conversation. Sometimes I'll admit it is hard for me to get perspective because I talk and think and read and write about colorism every day of my life. and so when I'm having conversations with people, sometimes I have to step back and realize that these people aren't thinking about it as much as I am, right? They haven't invested as much time into it as I have. And so a lot of people have a very narrow view of what colorism is because they are relying solely on their individual experience. And they haven't yet taken the time to step back and look at it at a societal level and look at it from a historical perspective. So a lot of times the conversation remains very surface or very shallow, right? Because people can say, well, you know, I've never been treated differently because of my skin tone, so I don't see why this is an important topic. We don't really need to talk about this. You know, if you just have confidence in yourself, then it's not an issue, right? But again, as a man I interviewed said, just because it's not your individual truth doesn't mean that historically and culturally it's not a truth, right? And so I definitely think that one of my goals is to help people process their personal stories, their individual issues, but to also help them be able to deconstruct and analyze how colorism is a systemic, cultural-wide issue, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. And, Ella, you know, this gets to when we talk about all the time about agency, you know, because it's a power relationship.
Yes.
And until we take control of the power labeling mechanism, then we'll always be socially and individually affected by it. So I definitely understand what you're saying. But is there anything else in the broad, because you seem to have interviewed and you've wrote a lot about people with their particular experience. Is there anything that jumped out that is memorable, and you mentioned about what happens in the classroom in relationship to people, their pain? I'm going to go from that point because you're talking about healing and colorism is healing. Mm-hmm. Their pain. Is there anything particularly that you think should share with us of how personally that pain is and how deep that pain affects people?
Yeah. And I thank you for asking that question in particular, because I'll say this first, that again, that pain and that hurt, like I talked about with the rape during institutional rape during slavery is part of the reason why it's hard to progress the conversation. And so that is why I focus on the healing, because I truly believe that until we heal some of that pain and hurt, then we won't have conversation at a sort of elevated consciousness, right, or like a more critical level.
Absolutely.
But the pain a lot of times comes from childhood, right? When we haven't yet developed our own coping mechanisms, or when we haven't yet learned how the world really is, right? And so those early childhood instances is what jumps out to me as being, as sticking with people into adulthood. So even if you don't experience colorism as an adult, you probably still feel some pain from your childhood. And a lot of it has to do with being called names. And you talk about labeling. Labeling is very important. And not only labeling, but like associations with the labels, right? So to label somebody black is technically a neutral term, but because of the associations to the term blackness, right? Because black is always associated with bad, with dirty, with ugly, or with, you know, usually negative things, that's why that label is so hurtful or so painful, or people try to reject it, right? And so I think, again, as you said, like switching our understandings and our definitions of these labels and these terms. But a lot of that pain comes from the labels and the words that people use. And again, as a writer, I'm kind of biased to focus on language, because I think it is so much a part of our consciousness and how we think. But a lot of it is rooted in language, in communicating with people, right? So being told something and not being told certain things, so being told that you're ugly feels about the same as not being told you're beautiful when other people are, right? And so there are a lot of times in like families, for example, there'll be children of different colors, even in a classroom, right? And so if there's a young African-American girl who looks biracial or who looks fair-skinned, and people are saying, oh, you're so beautiful, and look at your hair, you're so pretty. To girls who are not receiving that kind of attention and affirmation, you know, you think about like a 6-year-old girl, a 7-year-old girl, or boy, right, who's seeing this other person who doesn't look like them being affirmed and uplifted, that is sometimes just as hurtful as being told directly that you're ugly, right? And so a lot of that is where the pain and hurt comes from, because as children, you're kind of, you are the center of your universe, right? Again, you haven't developed that adult perspective yet. And so everything that people say to you or do to you, you start to question, like, is it, what's wrong with me? Why am I not good enough? And you just wonder, like, what you can do. And it's even more painful if it's coming from family. I was fortunate to where I didn't have like a mom who's like, oh, don't play in the sun, you know, that kind of thing. But a lot of the stories that people tell, it's the parent that has these colorist ideas, mm-hmm. and tells them, oh, you're too dark to wear that color, or you need to straighten your hair, or you won't look appropriate, or don't go outside, you're already too dark, and things like that. And to me, that, when you feel, that's kind of like a betrayal, right, from the one person, the parent or the caregiver, whether it's a grandmother, who's supposed to love you unconditionally, right, can't see past your skin color or the size of your nose or the texture of your hair. So in my research and reading and discussions with people, a lot of it stems from childhood experiences. And it, a lot of times it starts in the family.
Miss Webb, when I mention some things, I'm going to refer back to some of your articles. I want to read a portion of your article. I think this was still in the Roots and Routes of Colorism. And I want you to, because for 250 years during chattel enslavement period, or maybe a little beyond that, our people were conditioned to accept this behavior that was going on between slave, I won't call it a relationship at all, but the behavior that was going on by slave masters in relation to our women on these plantations. Some of the children, if you read the slave narratives, some of the children were never told about who these men were that committed these atrocities, but they kind of knew and didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
But after chattel enslavement ended and our people came off of the plantations, this behavior that was conditioned in our people took on a, I won't say a life of its own, I'll say a separate life that was related to to the original purpose. Mm-hmm. Let me read this portion of what you wrote and get you to expound on it before we start taking calls.
Okay.
You said, because of their obvious European ancestry, whites attributed biracial people, slave or free, with greater beauty, intelligence, and humanity than the general population of black people, slave or free. This is the white supremacist foundation of colorism in America. Light skin, straight hair, colored eyes, or keen facial features in people of color are privileged because the society takes those things as evidence of European ancestry. And it's that perceived connection to European ancestry that is so valued in American culture. These attitudes are quite clearly expressed in E.B. Reuter's 1917 article, The Superiority of the Mulatto. Reuter reports that the whole matter of the attitude of the white people and its consequent results in greater opportunities for work, more association, greater privileges, better training, and more freedom operated to the advantage of the mulattoes prior to the passing of the institution of slavery. The white man's assumption of mixed blood superiority capability, entirely aside from any question as to the accuracy of the assumption, created in the Negro race the tradition of mulatto superiority. It laid the basis for a class separation on the basis of skin color collaboration and for social prestige of mixed blood groups. And that type of thing still persists today. It takes on a life of its own, seem like every generation. Speak to what you wrote there, Ms. Webb.
Yeah, so thank you for reading that. I wrote these things a couple of years ago, so it's good to, like, refresh myself on a lot of these things. The continuation of, okay, so I'll start with the European ancestry was made visible through the features that people sort of put on a pedestal or think are beautiful or worthy, like light skin, straight hair, like hazel or green eyes. And then during slavery, that resulted in different treatment by the dominant class. And I also want to talk about what you said about how people were slaves were conditioned to accept that without speaking about it.
Okay.
I want to acknowledge the necessity of survival, right? So I don't want to say this in terms of like judging.
No, I understand.
Like, oh,
no,
they just accepted that.
I know it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate that the things we had to internalize to survive slavery did not disappear once slavery became illegal. If that makes sense, right? So it's kind of like if you have someone chained for 200 years and then you unchain them and say, hey, now you're not in chains, that person probably is not able to walk on their own right away, right? It's going to take some physical therapy, some reconditioning, some relearning to learn how to walk on your own after you've been trained for 200 years. And I think that's part of what we're seeing. But I also think if we consider the fact that even though slavery ended, white supremacy never did. And I think that's another reason why colorism persisted even after slavery, right? It's because, technically you can't own black people anymore. You can't force them to work for free unless, you know, they're in prison, which is a different conversation. The notion that white was better, that never ended. That still exists even today, even though people are resisting it more often, even though we see people working hard to, like, change that narrative. That definitely did not go away, even though the jure slavery did. And then you had things like Jim Crow, where a lot of African Americans still had to take any advantage they could to feed their families, right? So if having straight hair or if having a lighter skinned child means they're more likely to get a job, then that's what I'm going to do, right? But it's still, even post-slavery, it was still like a concern for survival, like literal survival, like can I make money to feed my kids? That is one aspect of it, right? But then you also have some of us who, it's not necessarily a matter of survival, but we actually like have internalized the ideology. A lot of times I refer to colorism as internalized racism, where you do believe that blackness is bad. You actually do believe that whiteness is better. You actually do believe that keener features or lighter colored eyes are prettier, not just that they give you greater access, right? And then going on to the article that you're quoting, the superiority of the mulatto, in certain areas in the South, in particular, in D.C., for example, during even through the civil rights movement, to be honest, because we talk about the civil rights movement as being pro-black and, you know, black is beautiful, I'm black and I'm proud. But even through the civil rights movement, there were communities of color of very fair-skinned blacks who segregated themselves. They were fair-skinned. They were typically middle class, typically a professional class, lawyers, doctors, things like that, who continued to separate themselves even past, you know, slavery, past the Harlem Renaissance and that whole era. So I think looking back at slavery, it's important to realize that even though slavery ended legally, the mechanisms that were the social conditioning and the mechanisms that that conditioned us psychologically, those things never really went away. And I think, again, that's why having conversations that don't just look at, you know, our individual experiences, but that look at it from the historical perspective and also consider how things work systemically are really important for that. That would be my talk back to the piece that you read.
Okay.
And I think it's important to add on the point of this power relationship, because as long as the system of white supremacy is only, it has that tool, that dual tool, as I see it, and I'm looking for your feedback on this, and that is, it does commodify light skin or skin tone, as you said, where you can economically benefit by being.
Right.
I mean, and that's systemic, and we have no control over that. In a more general sense, which we should, right? And then the other side of which we spoke about earlier is the image productions. You know, the continuous image production. That's a system too that that even if a person believes that, they only get to believe that because the imagery that is produced on a consistent, regular basis. And we've had examples with the was that the young male for H&M advertisement? We don't control that mechanism, so that those images continue to come out. And I think that until we, as you say, look at it historically and look at it systemically, but from the perspective, we're going to take agency, because I want your reflection on this. BET at one point could have been considered probably the most effective light skin, dark skin machine that was handled by a black person. Could we agree on that?
Yeah. So I just, okay, before I jump on the BET question, I just want to add to, for anybody who might be listening, who questions how much that persists today. Like, again, on my website, I have the index of like all the research articles, and they go up to present day articles. So there are people doing research as recently as 2015, 2016, 2017 that show that there is still wealth gaps and employment gaps and education gaps between African Americans with lighter skin and African Americans with darker skin, right? Now, they're not as extreme as like the ones between blacks in general and whites in general, but the fact that there is still a clear and consistent disparity amongst African Americans, you know, to me that still is equally as problematic, right? But with BET, I think what you said about BET being a very effective form of continuing this colorism debate or colorism issue is because it is all black, right? Precisely because it is an all black form of entertainment, it becomes very obvious what kind of black people are valued in our community, if that makes sense. So you can watch the Disney Channel, you can watch Lifetime, all the mainly white networks, and because you only see two or three people, black people every now and then, you know, the race takes precedent, right? So you might not notice too much, like, the color of the black people, you're just glad they're black, right? But once that's taken care of and everybody's black, then you're able to see, I can see little kids saying, okay, so in a society where most of the people are black, or in a context where most of the people are black, then who of us are valued, right? Who of us is able to move through a space more freely or more with more recognition, right? Or more acceptance and being embraced? Or who's being seen in the space, period, right? Not only how they enter the space, but are they even allowed to enter the space? And so I think because it is all black, BET made it very aware. And that's through music videos, you know, through the movies, through TV shows, and all of that. So definitely.
it's you know, and the reason I think that we need to, as you said, we need to, you know, keep expanding the discussion around it so we can, and hopefully to your point about healing, that because the other part of the healing process is when we take power and agency, because we bought into that, and that's light skin and dark skin bought into that. And so, which makes me, y'all making me smile, because I want to throw a curve out here on this subject, if y'all don't mind, because it seems to be a different reaction around Black Panther. Yeah,
go ahead, Richard.
Correct on that. Yeah, I mean, because the cast mostly dark skin, you know, people celebrated it, but we still know that the controlling mechanism of that image production machine is not black people, right? And we still have discussion about even now Africans that were projected dark compared to the one that was of mixed race, right? African American, who's not necessarily dark but angry and lighter when you look at the relationship to the other cast. So the production of imagery could be seen to be continuing. I'm not sure, but I'm asking, does that fit into your understanding of colorism?
Absolutely. So I think a few things are happening in the context of Black Panther. One is that Black Panther is the result of partly the result, right? Because I'm not going to say there's one cause for anything in the world. I think everything has multiple causes. But one of the reasons why Black Panther is able to be successful is because of things. For example, the Black Lives Matter movement, right? That's one thing. Because we are in an era in the United States where Black activism and Black pride and Black consciousness in general, and this does not go for everybody, is being raised. And people are using their agency, right? You have many, many prominent, successful Black people who have proven to major networks or major companies or major brands that they are capable and competent and talented and can draw a crowd and that sort of thing, right? And so I think a few years ago, like, a major network wouldn't have taken a chance on a movie like Black Panther, right? But I think the reason why it's celebrated is that even though the higher-ups the highest level of executives may not be black. There is enough agency on the part of the black people who are part of that team, right? So there's enough agency in the black director. There's enough agency in the black screenwriters. And there's enough agency in the black cast, right, to then take it from there, right? So, yes, white people might have given us the money to do it, but now that it's in our hands, as the writers and the directors and the actors, we're going to do it justice for our people. And I think that's kind of why we're like, okay, so Black Panther represents progress. And again, I say progress because it's not a perfect product, right? But man, it surely is a far cry from what was available even when I was a kid, you know, and I don't even consider myself to be that old. So that's my take on why people are so excited about Black Panther. And then you think about people like Ava DuVernay and Oprah Winfrey, who do produce and direct and write their own stuff from the ground up, right, that are getting more recognition and becoming more popular. So I think it's just we're in an era where a film like Black Panther could exist to begin with.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, you can join the conversation with us, with our guest, Sarah L. Webb, writer, educator, and advocate, and activist, and founder of the website Colorism Healing. In fact, before we wind up this evening, Ms. Webb, we're going to talk about some of the ways that you help young girls, young boys, adult women and men start the healing process, because I think when we talk about all this and when we get down to it, our people need to find ways to heal themselves. The ones who created this problem is not interested in finding any healing for us. The solutions for this problem must come from us. And you've been dealing with ways to help people get beyond this. And it's necessary that we get beyond this, because it seems like every generation that comes up, this thing comes right back up. And you can't blame the young people. You've got to look at the adults. You have to. So when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation. Folks can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832 to be part of this conversation. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache, customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
In 1492, you came up on these shores, 700 years educated by the Moors, 17th century. Genocide in the gun. Middle passage blessed to market the Africans in the so-called land of God. My kind were treated hard. From back then until now, I see and you agree. We have been a misrepresented people from back then until now. Just see my family tree. We have been a misrepresented people. We have been a misrepresented people. Yeah.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. We're joined the conversation this evening with PhD candidate and English writer, educator, advocate, and activist, Ms. Sarah L. Webb is joining us this evening. The roots and routes of colorism is a topic of discussion and related issues dealing with this problem that still exists among our people that was created by Europeans on our ancestors and takes on a life of its own even in 2018. But we have to be the ones to come up with the solution to stop it. Ms. Webb, before I go, I think we got a couple calls on hold, and other folks can join the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. In one of your articles, you talk about colorism as a potential blind spot in black history. And I'm going to read the first paragraph, and you can take it from there. I also caution us not to assume that celebrating black history in and of itself heals us from colorism. Typically, Black History Month focuses on the accomplishments of black Americans over the years. However, if we're not careful, we send a message that light-skinned blacks are the ones who are more accomplished and worthy of celebration. And we see that acted out, and some of our people that don't realize it. And see, you know, Ms. Webb, and you can explain it better than me. I think a lot of this subconscious behavior comes out, and some people don't realize it.
Yes.
If you look at, and I'll give an example, my example, and then you can kind of go into others. Mm-hmm. If you look at our experiences here, you've had people that, like Frederick Douglass and others, that came from rape our ancestors, but clearly considered themselves black men and women.
Right.
But you had others that were major contributors. In fact, one of the men that I see in history as one of the most, if you were counting 1 to 10 or 1 to 5, one of the most influential black men of our experiences here in the United States was Marcus Garvey. And one of the reasons why Marcus Garvey, in my estimation, is not reverenced among black people was because of his complexion. And if you notice, some of our most intelligent, W.E.B. Du Bois, attacked Marcus Garvey's complexion, equated him to a gorilla in certain publications. Richard, you can clear me up if I'm going off track.
Yeah.
But I mean, these things was acted out among some of our talented tenths, so to speak. Martin Delaney's another one. Martin Delaney is a man that contributed mightily to our experiences here. And because he was of dark complexion, you don't see much of him mentioned in our history. In fact, if you did a poll with some of our children in class or even adults, they wouldn't be able to tell you much about Martin Delaney at all. Talk about that issue, and then we got some calls on who I wanted to bring them into the conversation.
Thank you for mentioning that. So it goes back again to the fact that descendants of mulatto slaves were more likely to be educated, right? Were more likely to have trades and professions, right? And so then for generations later, they were the ones getting degrees, even from HBCUs, you know. They were the ones becoming doctors and lawyers in terms of general terms, right? Not that there wasn't ever a dark-skinned person to go to college back then. But the majority of people, because of the history of slavery, the majority of black people who had access to education and to a more affluent lifestyle, more middle-class lifestyle, were the lighter-skinned blacks, right? So W.E.B. Du Bois going to Harvard is not a coincidence, right? Being, you know, the first black person to do something, a lot of times is because you come from a family that had been afforded certain privileges in the past due to their fair skin or ancestry. And I think recognizing that, right, so when we say, oh, all these accomplished black people, we need to acknowledge, like, why so many of them might be light-skinned, right? Like, why are so many of the first black this or the first black that happen to be light-skinned people? So, A, it could be, again, they come from families that had been granted more access in society. And so they then had the chance to be educated and become doctors or lawyers. But also, at the time, especially at that time, like white society would have been more likely to hire you if you made them feel comfortable in some way. Mm. If your blackness wasn't so in their face or so jarring to them, right? You were more palatable, so to speak, right? So that gave them greater access too. So I think even if we say, oh, this light-skinned person needs to be honored because they were the first person to do something, I think we also need to acknowledge in that conversation why so many of those people who were the first this or the first that happened to be light-skinned. And then on the other hand, like both of you acknowledged, like black people have internalized this too. And a recent example that I used was the Black is Beautiful movement, because I hear a lot of light-skinned women especially say that they felt like they were left out of the Black is Beautiful movement or that it didn't include them. But I question that, because who are the icons from that era? Who are the iconic women from that era, right? Angela Davis,
right.
Kathleen Cleaver,
right.
Very, very fair-skinned women with more Eurocentric features, looser curl patterns in their hair, right? So even during an era when people were raising their fists and talking about black power, a lot of those leaders were fair-skinned, right? So, you know, we talk a lot about how that was a time when black consciousness was at a peak. And yet, even then, a lot of the people put in the forefront, put out as leaders, put out as speakers and icons of the movement were still very, very fair-skinned. African-Americans. And then you think about even among the men, even if you look at the male leaders, a lot of them were also more fair-skinned. And I love that you acknowledge that it's subconscious, that mm-hmm. it's unconscious. We talk about implicit bias with police shootings, for example. We talk about how white people might have implicit racism. Well, I definitely believe, and there's research that colorism is also very implicit. So you might not consciously be telling children not to play in the sun, but you might have a reaction. You might not be aware that you are treating someone slightly better because you think they're more beautiful or you like their hair texture or their skin color, right? So I think that helps a lot, is when we acknowledge that we might be doing things unconsciously or implicitly.
You know, Sister Webb and Elliot, y'all raised like 3 points in my mind, and I because I remember here at Temple, there was some sisters. Now they are professors or teaching, and they did a presentation talking about the '60s, the Black Power movement, where the imagery, how it the black is beautiful, was so captivating. And then mm-hmm. how Revlon as a company started to try to, you know, over, because that was an organic accepting. And even if you say the question about the imagery as far as, you know, women who are fair skin or lightly pigmented, they still the identity was that we're still black. It was a unified identity. And Revlon mm-hmm. took that from the hair and went from mm-hmm. the afro to the jerry curl to the perm. It was mm-hmm. a deliberate marketing strategy, you
wow.
know, that you
yeah.
could see. And they showed in the imagery how that was done, which raises mm-hmm. my question to the point that Elliot was making. Why has never, in your opinion, this inward frustration about colorism ever taken on the form of political demand, in whether it be consumer demand, whether it be political power, as an example, when at one point, especially I believe when Obama came in, there was a notion of changing and wanting to change. Biracial felt that there should be a classification in the census in order to identify specifically biracial parent. Why hasn't it been a unified effort to deal with the political aspect of colorism, in your opinion? Inward frustration.
Yeah. I think there are a few reasons. I think the frustration is inward because there has not been, because it's taboo. It's been so taboo, right? So even though we've had this inward frustration, a lot of times we have been there's an unspoken rule that you're supposed to just keep that to yourself. There's an unspoken rule that, oh, we have bigger problems to deal with. There's an unspoken, well, not even unspoken, people have said this explicitly, you know, like, why are we worried about colorism when there's X, Y, and Z going on, i.e. racism or hunger or poverty? And so in my experience, colorism has been dismissed as a trivial issue. It has been dismissed as something that's not political. It has been misunderstood, and that's why I try so hard to talk about the research that talks about the systemic problems and the disparities in education and income, because people dismiss it as trivial and as less important if they think it's just a matter of who is the cute girl in school, who do all the boys want to date, right? And a lot of times we try to reduce colorism to just that. Like, oh, if dark-skinned women just think they're beautiful, then colorism will be over. So I think because there's a lack of knowledge about the fact that colorism is systemic, right? There's a lack of awareness about how colorism manifests in employment, on the job market, you know, in education. And so I think that's one of the biggest reasons why there hasn't been, like, political organization around the issue. It's because so many of us still to this day think that it's just a matter of, like, who's a cute girl and who's not. So that's my simple answer to that.
It's valid, you know. And Ellie, you know, you raised this point about the slave master and slave master and the whole creation of a and it's hard for me to deal with this because I know the reality, as you can see, is struggling, because I realize this is mulatto, quote unquote, mulatto class has been created as a part of this structure of white supremacy. So the thing that gets me is that do we have an overriding image, even though we're not dealing with the colorism politically and we're dealing with our personal frustration? If we were in control of the image production, do we have an image that celebrates all that we can project, that celebrates this, that overrides this colorism that is really reinforced by the system of white supremacy?
That's a good question. I think those images are becoming more prevalent. I actually just pulled up a slide of Ebony Magazine from 1966. And so we think about a Black-owned media brand. And the cover asks, "Are Negro girls getting prettier?" And there are six women on the cover, and three of them are very, very fair-skinned. And then one woman is a brown tone. Mm-hmm. And you think about 1966, again, this is the height of the Black Power movement. The height of the Black is Beautiful movement, you know, the Black Panther Party was started in the mid-60s, you know. And so for a very explicitly Black beauty magazine like Ebony to equate Negro prettiness or Negro beauty with five very light-skinned women and one brown-skinned woman, I think it points to the fact that even when we do have control, we still have a lot of work to do to decolonize our minds, to reprogram ourselves for us to see Black as beautiful, right? So it's not just enough for us to get control. We also have to get control of our minds too, right? So whether or not we control the media is pointless if we are just going to perpetuate the same thing. And so I do think that there are more people doing that work. I think there are more opportunities cropping up. And I think the internet has helped a lot, because you don't have to have a whole lot of money, right, to build a platform and to put out diverse images of Blackness. So that has definitely helped a lot. I think, when Black people started getting control of media, there are some who have done a good job of representing Blackness in its diversity. In the past, we've had Black directors who have essentially done the same thing that white people did in terms of casting, right, in terms of storyline. Yes. So I think recently, in the, I would say, past 5 or 10 years, Black people who have control of the media have been thinking more, right? Not that we're always going to get it perfect. Not that everybody's going to be pleased all the time, because that's not possible. There's always going to be some gripe. But I at least see Black media corporations and Black people who have control of media at least trying, consciously, intentionally trying to change the narrative around skin tone and what's valuable in terms of skin tone and hair texture and things like that.
Let's go to 225. It's a 225 error code. 225, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Jandell Crutchfield. I'm calling from North Mississippi.
Mm. Thank you for your call. Get involved in the community.
You hear me say, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I haven't been on the entire podcast, so I'm not sure if you guys have addressed this already, but as a lighter-skinned African-American, I'm wondering if you guys can talk about how lighter-skinned people can be allies in this discussion and, you know, a political movement that might happen. I think about recently a young actress, lighter-skinned actress, that said that she turned down a role, you know, in the Black Panther, realizing that there's some spaces she shouldn't occupy. And yeah. so does it look like that? You know, I'm not a famous person, but what does it look like in terms of, you know, you guys having the allies to make a change in the movement?
Well, go ahead, Ms. Webb, you, ladies first, and then I'll kind of chime in. Go ahead.
Okay. Again, I think about all of this all the time. But I have a couple of answers for you. First, I will say that it's going to be different for everybody. But some general things you can do, A, is to not accept, right, to reject people who put your lighter skin on a pedestal, right? So a very simple example, if a man tells you, oh, I really like you because you light skin, you know, I love light skin girls. If you want to help make change and you want to say, like, use some of your privilege to change mindsets, you can say, no, I reject that. And precisely because you said that, you're not someone I want to date, right? I don't want to date a man who's so focused on skin color, right, or who would reject a whole group of people because of their skin color, right? And it's not just with dating amongst African Americans. It could be at the job, right? You could hear comments in your family. You could hear comments at church, right? People saying things that perpetuate colorism. And so as a lighter-skinned person, speaking up and not just quietly accepting that, right? So, and I talked about, like, for example, I don't expect kids to do this, but if you're a light-skinned woman who's being told you're beautiful, you're beautiful, beautiful, and you have a dark-skinned person in the room, you might say, yeah, you know, so-and-so is also beautiful, right? I think we need to acknowledge the beauty of all skin tones, right? As a light-skinned woman, a lot of people think I'm beautiful, but all Black people are beautiful, right? So I think being willing to speak up when you notice colorism is really important, and not accepting benefits that come purely because of your color, I think, is one of the biggest things that you can do. And I'm curious to see what Brother Elliot and Brother Richard have to say, too.
Well, you know, I look at it similar to what you're saying, Sister Webb. Personally, I look at all of our people as being the same. I don't delineate light-skinned sister or dark-skinned sister or dark-skinned brother, light-skinned brother, because we're all in this struggle together. The reason I even brought this subject up is because I want us to realize that this whole caste system was created by somebody else and it has taken on a new life among our own people. So, you know, if a dark-skinned brother goes out here and wants to date a dark-skinned sister or a light-skinned sister, she's Black as far as I'm concerned. The problem is when you have a brother that intentionally goes out here to only date a light-skinned sister or date a white woman because he doesn't have a desire to date all complexions of his own people. That's when the problem comes in. You know, I have a business, and 90% of my business is African-American. I guess I'm blessed in that respect that most of my customers are black. And I was talking to a customer that has been a good friend for a number of years. And this is what I'm talking about some of this stuff, and I'll use the term stuff, being subconscious. He was telling me about his brother, and his brother has been married for the third time. And he said, maybe my brother will get it right now. He married a sister is his third wife. I said, oh, a sister? He said, yeah, his first two were white. And I said, oh. And he said, well, you know, the good thing about it is that the children that he had, my nieces and nephews, are really beautiful. And I'm saying, I'm saying to him, like, well, if he married a black woman and you had nieces and nephews, wouldn't they be beautiful? Mm-hmm. And the expression on his face, like, he didn't realize what he said. See, a lot of this foolishness is subconscious, and we don't realize it. But the minute we talk about this in a sensible forum and realize what we need to do, then we can stop it. It's too many of our children now. Listen, turn on, Richard mentioned BET. Turn on one of those stations that play a lot of rap videos and look at our young people. The standard of beauty is somebody light. A lot of times they're not even black.
Right.
And black women are frowned upon. Look at the athletes. Soon as they get money, or entertainers, soon as they get some money, and I'm not saying all of them, but a majority of them, soon as they get some money, they want a white woman. They want somebody other than a black woman. To me, that's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Richard?
Yeah, sister, I appreciate your question because it brings up a couple on my in my personal experience. My sister, on her second marriage, I'm one of those, I am a child of the 60s, 50s, 60s. And I am been always in my adult life, you know, towards black African liberation. So when she decided she wanted to get married again, she was marrying someone from the neighborhood, but he was white. And she knew how I was. I had an African wedding and all. So she knew. And she deliberately she felt that she had to come to me to let me know that that the person that she wanted to marry was white. Not for my okay or anything, but I guess just to, so that we wouldn't have any, she wouldn't be, or I wouldn't be off the wall about it, which I wasn't. It's like, is your choice. So in relationship to allies, my issue is that we recognize that regardless of our color, that we're in a system that created the condition, and it's our responsibility to do, as you said, Sister Webb, and you said, Elliot, do everything in our power to dismantle the system that provides the benefit, have provided, and can in the future provide the benefit based off of color. We know that it has historical reference. We know that it's a system. We know that there's people who benefit from that system, image production and the whole bit. So it's our responsibility to deal with that. And then at that point, we're become allies, because what we are doing is working to dismantle a system that really is set up to divide us and put in place a system that unifies us. That's what I mean, that's my, and I believe that's abstract, but that's what I believe, that we're the allies, because we shouldn't have to look like, because I'm light-skinned or because I'm dark-skinned, that we have to negotiate with each other. The system that is creating the condition is not negotiating. It's putting us all in the same bag. So it's, if we're saying we're against that, now, the reality of our history is some saying that I support that system that divides us, and that we have to know them, and they could be light skinned or they can be dark skinned.
Yes.
So that's my, short reaction without, but I really appreciate, raising that question to us in that manner.
Thank you for the question. Definitely. Thanks.
And sister, don't be a stranger. What's your name again?
Jandell Crutchfield.
Well, don't be a stranger, Endel, and we're allies. We're allies in this struggle.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay, have a good evening. Let's go to 215. 215.
Hey, Brother Elliot. How you doing, my brother?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Hey, Brother Richard.
Yeah, how you doing now?
All right. Hey, hi, Sister Webb. How you doing, my dear sister?
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. All praises be to Allah. I want to say first, Sister Webb, I think the way you talk to the sister, that's a true example of black sisterhood, the way you talk to the beautiful sister just now, who happened to be of a lighter skin here, and you gave some good advice, and like you told her, you said if you were in the room with some brothers and stuff, and they was talking about some, oh, you're just beautiful, you light skin, because you know you light skinned it, and you told her that look, if it's a dark skinned sister, say hey, look, well, I may be light skinned, but look, all of us are beautiful and stuff, whether mm-hmm. we dark skinned or light skinned. So I think the woman to woman black sisterhood talk that you gave us, the way it was beautiful. I mean, it was, to me, it was priceless, and that's one to thank you for that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You know, Sister Webb, I take the position that our late ancestor, Baba Dick Gregory, took and stuff. He said, I blame white folks for everything. He said, when I get up in the morning, he said, I feel bad. He said, I blame it on white folks. He said, I pass gas in the morning. It's white folks' fault. He said, I take that position, too, because when we see the infighting, Sister Webb, that we deal with the color thing, I blame it, again, like Brother Gregory said, all in white folks, because when you look at it, how insidious this thing is, because I look at Brother Malcolm, Al-Hajj Malik Shabazz. Malcolm said in his autobiography about how, as you know, Sister Webb, Malcolm's mother was from the West Indies. She was real, real light-skinned. Mm-hmm. Malcolm's mm-hmm. father was dark-skinned. He was a Garveyite. And Malcolm said, right in the autobiography, he said, my father kind of like, favored me to a large degree because I was the lighter skinned child. He said, mm-hmm. whereas my mother, she was light and stuff. He said she kind of favored my darker skinned brother. They all was probably to the same mother and father. Mm-hmm. But he said his mother, because she was real, real light skinned, and she felt the kinship more towards Marvin's brother, Philbert, and his sister, you know, I forgot his sister's name, but she felt more of a kinship towards them because they were the darker skinned children. And you see mm-hmm. How this stuff is so insidious. And I think just by, you know, you and Brother Elliot and Brother Richard raising it, this is part of the healing process. This, like Elliot said, we can discuss this honestly and openly, you know, without being insulting and just have it openly. Because mm-hmm. to me, Sister Webb, this is part of the healing process. If it's going to be taboo and nobody want to talk about it, then we can never heal from this stuff. So I think just talking exactly. about it, and like the sister that called before me, when she brought it up, I think she was an honest question. And I think that, like I said, the advice you gave was part of the healing process. So I think just talking about it, we can, heal, you know, we can keep be on a road to recovery. Because you see how sick these people who credit this stuff, like, and it's funny that Brother Elliot, when he came on, Sister Webb, I don't know if you heard Brother Elliot's comments when he came on, because right on this black radio station here in Philadelphia, WRD, at the terrestrial radio station, 2 days mm-hmm. in a row, they was talking about just what Elliot was talking about tonight. On a Saturday mm-hmm. show yesterday, the brother was talking about the curse of Ham, you know, about how, you know, why black Christians don't challenge their white Christian brethren and sister about this curse of Ham and stuff, about how this is clearly a thing of white supremacy. They try to, you know, justify slavery and the mistreatment of black people. And then on today's mm-hmm. show, the brother that's an activist lawyer, he was talking about the Thomas Jefferson, Sally Henny thing, where you got sick white folks still trying to say that was a love affair. And a good friend of mine who's a friend of this show who passed on, Sister Webb, he jumped on this white girl several years ago at the Institute here in Philadelphia. He said, how dare you say this was a love affair when you had a 13-year-old girl mm-hmm. and this white bastard sat there and raped her and filed the children with her. It wasn't no love affair. When you know darn well, if that was the other way around, that black man would be hanging from a rope from a tree somewhere. So you see, Claire, this is the kind of sickness that we have to constantly deal with. So that's why I'm just so full of myself right now, Sister Webb, that we discuss this, because this thing has got to be talked about, because I tell you, it's something that has divided our people. Because you see, clearly, at churches, I remember this was discussed yesterday on yesterday's show about how back in the 50s here in Philadelphia, Sister Webb, you had black folks in the church that was all Christian, but you had some of our lightest consistent brothers, they sat on one part of the church, and the darkest can one sat on the other side of the church. This was mm-hmm. going on right here in Philadelphia during the 50s and stuff like that. And thank God you don't see that stuff going on now here in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. at least to my knowledge, it's not going on. But it just points out part and partial to how insidious and how damaging white supremacy is. And it's like Brother Elliot says, it's up to us to come up with a solution to overcome these things, because you mm-hmm. see clearly that you see how, you know, when you look at a person's skin pigmentation, that's not always the you can always put a proper, for lack of a better word, a proper definition on where their mindset is at. Because you look at a guy like Clarence Thomas, who's a dark-skinned brother, but he got a white man's mentality. Then you look at a brother like Malcolm X, who was light-skinned but who loves our people. So, I mean, you see that dynamic. It's always ever evolving, ever-changing and stuff like that. But, again, I'll just close with by saying this. I'm enjoying this show. I'm learning something myself tonight because I know I had an aunt, and I'll close with this, Sister Webb. I had an aunt, Maddie, that was my father's aunt on my father's side. She was real, real light-skinned. We used to go see up in Washington, D.C. when we was children back in the 70s. I thought she was, when I first met her, I thought she was white because she's real, real fair-skinned. And let me tell you, Sister Webb, though she was real fair-skinned, could probably pass white. She couldn't stand white people, hated white people. I mean, she hated white people for passion. You know, she could, you know, almost pass for one. So you can see clearly the incidents that the white supremacy and white racism has did to our people. And that's why it's important for people like yourself, Sister Webb, and Brother Elliot, Brother Richard, myself, and others to try to come up with solutions that so our people can overcome this thing. Because, again, I love our people, whether they're light-skinned, dark-skinned, brown-skinned, reddish-looking, whatever the case may be. But one thing I don't like, and I make no bones about it, Sister Webb, I hate this the thing about white racism, white supremacy. And I kind of hate to use that term now because a friend told me, Joe, nothing supreme about white people. So I try to, you know, keep from using that term as much as I can, though I do refer back to it here and there. So I'm all about destroying this myth about white supremacy and white beauty. And see, white people are so arrogant, as you know, Sister Webb. They put some little bony-faced white girl up on TV with blonde hair and blue eyes, and they expect the whole world to say that's beauty. That they, well, every people around the world, everybody around the world don't look at her as being beautiful. You may look at her as being beautiful as a white man or a white woman, but people around the world, they look at her and don't see nothing attractive about her because white supremacy is so insidious that it is. They think, in their arrogance, they think because she's white and she got blonde hair and blue eyes or brown hair, whatever the case may be, they think because they say she's beautiful, the whole world's full of accept her as beautiful, and that's far from the truth, you know. So this is what we're dealing with, Sister Webb. And again, I just thank you for doing what you do, and I thank Brother Rich and Brother Ellis for bringing you on tonight, because I'm gonna sit back to the rest of the show and listen and learn, because like I said, I'll be the first to tell you I got some learning to do myself, because again, I was affected by white supremacy. I know when I was growing up and stuff. And I closed with this, Sister Webb, in North Philadelphia, when I used to see the Cowboys and Indians, when they used to show the dark-skinned brothers in the jungles of Africa with the spears and everything like that, and the bones and nose, I used to say, Carson, kill them savage, kill them ends, because I didn't know no better. I was a young child, I was ignorant and stuff. I felt so bad about it as I grew older to realize what I was saying, you know what I mean? So you live and you learn, but it just shows you how the damage and what white supremacy has did to how people could have me rooting for a white man, and Johnny Weissmuller to kill our own people and stuff like that. So, again, time, like Elliot and them show says, time for an awakening. So people like yourself, y'all part of the awakening process. And Sister Webb, I just thank you for what you do. And I just pray, may God bless you to keep doing what you're doing, keep waking our people up throughout this United States and throughout this world. Thank you so much for your time.
And thank you, brother.
You're welcome.
For your comments.
Let's go to 215 again. That's 215.
Yes, I would like to talk about, good afternoon to everyone.
How are you, sir?
Good afternoon.
Yes, I would like to talk about white women. You remember years ago, I think in the 80s, a guy named Reginald Lewis, he owned Kraft Foods, he owned quite a few businesses. He was probably one of the first billionaires. And this guy married a white woman, and he ended up dying from using a cell phone, and he ended up getting cancer of the brain and died. And when he died, his white wife took every dime of that money and just disappeared. And that's one of the problems with our community is when we do get money in our hands, we run the white women. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're in the condition that we're in, because if you look at athletes, when the cheerleaders and all of them are mostly all white and they're little short dresses on, and they're tempting these guys, and they end up marrying white women. And I think that's why we are in the condition that we're in, because it's temptation and that white flesh. And if you look at in Hollywood, all the entertainers and the singers and movie stars, Magic Johnson, not Magic Johnson, I forgot, Jordan, dumped his sister, and now he got a white woman. So when he passed away, that money goes right back into their community, and we're back in the poorhouse again. That's just my my opinion.
I it's only one thing that I would like to, I can't be totally factual. I think with Reginald Lewis, his wife was Filipino. And I think that, and now even with his children, but one thing that I think she identified with his, I'm gonna call it his wishes, because I don't know the details, because we know that in Baltimore, there is the right. Reginald Lewis Museum, and it is dedicated to the history of Black, Baltimoreans. So she has taken that money, and they are the ones, like, and unlike in other areas like Philadelphia, where the museum is financed by the city, the African American Museum is financed by the city. The Reginald Lewis Foundation finances that Reginald Lewis Museum, and the daughters, I believe, set up a program for science and technology. Now, my memory is a little fuzzy on it, but I believe they had made some connection, but it was to deal with, to raise the science and technology skills of African-American youth, you know, particularly. So I'm saying that, you know, as has been said already, that it's kind of difficult to make a blanket, even though the other examples that you use, I would agree with, but it's difficult to make a blanket statement in relationship to the transfer. It's definitely in principle there is a transfer of wealth, but the you know, just being clear that, and that's why this colorism thing is really so important, powerful, because it's about identity in the end, not necessarily color. It's how you identify, as Brother Joe said earlier. Because there's a lot of fair poorly pigmented individuals that they will not accept that they're not Black. And that's been a part of the American experience from slavery on, mm-hmm. enslavement on. They, you know, so we just have to be careful of that. But I understand your point in general. It was just that fact that I wanted to.
I stand corrected on that, and I appreciate you straighten that out for me. I thought that for years that she was a Caucasian.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a good thing. But then we have, I mean, I can name 300 right. more
right.
that do, you know, that's Sophie Rich right now, Bob Johns, that BET. You know, these guys are, you know, it really just bothers me that we Black men, Black men and women, once you get a dollar, you run from Black women. And Black women have the strength that is unbelievable. And it just sickens me that we run to white women.
Well, and brother, that's kind of why we're dealing with the subject tonight, because a lot of this behavior, man, you know, some people talk about it like they're proud of their actions, but a lot of this behavior is subconscious, and some of these people they don't realize it. And I'm not trying to take the onus off of them, because we're all responsible for what we do. But a lot of that behavior.
You really believe that?
Say that again.
You really believe? Yeah, I mean, you really do believe that some of them don't. That they believe that it's, I just don't believe that. I think
you don't believe,
you know,
what?
Because men are visual, and when you see something that you like, you're gonna go at it. And if you and if this country and this system, institutional racism, gives to everything being white and pure, you're gonna gravitate towards that.
Well, that's what I'm saying about it being subconscious and,
yeah, right,
and
okay,
subliminal.
Well, that's what you're saying.
Because, I'm in a household where my mother, all of my relatives, the women in my family, were black women. And a lot of them, I mean, some were more conscious than others, but I was around black women. They were part of my family. I had a father and mother. But it's not like when I became an adult that all of a sudden my affinity was towards white women, and I have no interest in black women. It's something that's wrong with that picture. And a lot of our people try to, they seem sensible, and they'll use the excuse why I love who I want to love, but it's a little deeper than that. It's a lot deeper than that. I mean, Sister Webb has been dealing.
Add a little bit.
Yes.
I know a lot of black men who say that there are a couple of reasons why that happens. So a lot of times the men really just don't understand that they've been conditioned to see whiteness as beautiful and valuable and attractive. But some men have said that because they don't want their children to be dark-skinned, then they will marry a white woman. It's kind of like the gentleman who, I think it was Brother Elliot, he was talking about a family member who was married to two white women before, and somebody made a comment about the fact that his children were beautiful because their mom was white. So I think a lot of black men have said, like, explicitly, they consciously say this, right? They don't want their children to come out dark-skinned, so they choose to marry non-black women, like either a Latina woman or an Asian woman or a white woman, so that they can have light-skinned children. But then a lot of black men, too, a lot of times it is self-hatred. Like, they don't like being dark-skinned. So it's not just it's not all subconscious. It might be subconscious in terms of how it happened.
Okay.
But a lot of them explicitly state the reasons why they choose to date white women.
Well, what I hear, because I have a cousin that's a police officer, and he was married to a sister, had children by, and he beat her. And then he married a Caucasian. And they've been married for 20-something years now. Nothing. Just they get along perfect. But with the sister, he was always putting his hands on her. And I think that's just a sickness that we have. And we go at it all the time. And I let him have it, that it's a sickness that we have. When you get a white woman, you treat her like that's a piece of gold. Then with the sister, you're always, because he says she has attitude. She always got, but she has attitudes because, like I explained to him, what we need to understand is try to live, and I told his white wife, try to live 3 months on a slave ship, and you have your father beside you dead, your mother on the other side, your baby at your foot dead, rats running through their bodies, eating them, and your wife is at the top of you, crying for you to you to save her. And as a man, your job, we're put on this earth to try to protect our family. So, and you live 3 months and you survive that. That's why we're in the condition that we're in today. The trauma, that trauma has manifested itself right on up until today. I see it right now with a lot of these young boys. I see that. That's trauma. That is total trauma. And then why would you want to go and marry one of the white ones? And the slave owners is sitting at the top of the ship eating papaya juice, and you're down there, and your family being eaten by rats.
I think that because a lot of times, Sister Weber raised the point about the individualization of this, because even if we're even accepting the trauma, even accepting the conditioning, even accepting, that the favoritism towards whites, we're also accepting as in general, as a collective, we're accepting a system that we know has not been favorable to us. And we've been trying to reform it to make it better so that we can live in it, even though it was established not to have us live in it. Now, do we say that we're all sick? You know, which some say.
No.
And that's the point. We wouldn't say, but when it gets to an individual relationship, we might say that the individual said. So what I'm always raising a question for us when we're dealing with these this type of stuff, it's a manifestation at an individual level, but it's more a manifestation of our collective decision. And it relates to what we have to do, because if we know we're traumatized, are we expecting young people to do the healing for themselves, knowing that they're traumatized? That's the responsibility for black males, black females, to create a net around them to assist them from being trauma to health, as the sister is doing with this, you know, raising the point of colorism and the healing process. She recognized that we have to do healing. So I'm saying that we have to make sure we're clear that this is a collective reality and a system that is imposing. And until we, as a collective, with all the individual variations, move to one, either dismantle it or to create a system where it doesn't affect us, where this is what we're looking at is the manifestation of that.
Okay.
So that's, I just, you know, because we can get bogged down in calling each other, which is what this, if correct me if I'm wrong, Sister Webb, even with colorism, it can get the, you know, calling the light skin can say the dark skin don't understand. The dark skin can say the light skin don't understand. And we're divided, but we're divided by a system that created the condition.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't create it.
Right.
Thank you for your call.
Go ahead. Right. Now, I just thank God that I'm in my mid-60s, and I've never touched a white woman. I don't have no desire to even... I've never physically touched one, and I don't have the desire to touch one. And I thank God every day that's inside of me. I have no desire for them, none whatsoever.
Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Denver, Colorado. Denver.
Good evening, Elliot. Richard.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. How you doing, Miss Webb? Welcome to the show. Thank you for giving your expertise in this subject matter here.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I first need to see if I'm still in the conversation here. Are we talking mulatto versus light-skinned black people who just light-skinned because their mama can produce several colors of shades of black?
Well, no, I don't think we're necessarily talking about the versus anything, to be honest.
Are we talking about how colorism works differently from being a mulatto versus a black person who's just really light-skinned?
Well, go ahead, Romain. Maybe you ought to be able to ask your question. That way Sister Webb can kind of see where you're going.
Okay. Well, the reason why I bring that up is because immediately offhand, I share in everything Mrs. Webb said. I think where I start to see there's a different type of strategy is when there's a mulatto faction involved in the colorism. The one thing that stands out to me is if they have a white parent still involved in their life, they have an advantage that the light-skinned black person that probably could pass for white still doesn't have. If they have to introduce their parent, a mulatto can bring one half, which would be the white, and kind of get get a pass. Versus just a real light-skinned black person, if they had to bring both their parents, they wouldn't be able to get that pass. So I guess what I'm saying is she said some things that kind of made me realize that even in a black liberation, the only way the world or the society we live in is going to even accept it or tolerate it for a moment is you're still going to have a light-skinned face yelling, "I'm black and I'm proud." Is that kind of what
Brother Marone, because I missed the last part. You're saying, okay, the scenario is if there is a black liberation, that last part I didn't get. I'm trying to get the point on.
Yeah, you know, even in a black, I'm black and I'm proud type of scenario, only way it will even get tolerated for a brief moment is if it has a light-skinned face leading the charge.
Well, when you say tolerated, tolerated by who?
I mean, for a minute, they will let it be televised and kind of get the word out till they get tired of us, and then they'll put a bullet in one of us.
Well, isn't that another dynamics, but it does.
Well, I'm saying kind of presents all that within the colorism.
Right.
You know, it stages it for like, even for, here's some things I noticed growing up in the Bible Belt down there in the South. You still got a faction internally that fights amongst each other with the coin phrase like red bone and stuff like that. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it gets so minute and splintered that you start having to ask yourself, and this is one of my questions to you, Ms. Webb, was it, you know, is this a strategy of war that came before or after slavery?
Mm-hmm. So I think there are a few things I could say. One, I think the term mulatto is used specifically during slavery. Now that term, mixed race people, probably wouldn't refer to themselves as mulatto. I don't know people who still use that word for like people existing today. So we use the word mulatto to talk specifically about the context of slavery, which is a little different from what you're talking about with like present day biracial people. Because I think a lot of the what you call light-skinned blacks who are just light-skinned blacks who don't have a white parent, a lot of them still descended from people who were mulattoes during slavery, right? So that's partly how we have so many different shades of black people who are quote-unquote just black, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have black people who have two black parents, but they might be very, very fair-skinned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because of the mulatto races of people that existed during slavery. Now, in terms of mixed-race black people today, and I call them black people. Not all of them would identify as black, and not all of them want to be considered that. But for mixed race black people who do identify as black, who do say I'm black, even though I have a white parent, I actually agree with you that it's different because having a white parent, especially if they were raised by the white parent, especially if they still have a relationship with the white parent, that does afford them a different kind of access in American society than someone who might look just like them, but who's both of their parents are black. But I think out in the world, right, people don't know what your parents look like. So yeah, if people meet your parents, then that could make a difference. But color, a lot of times when we have experiences with colorism, people don't know what our parents look like, right? So if a light-skinned black person has two black parents, but they still look as light as a person with a white parent, then their experiences might be similar, right? So I think that would be the only caveat, is that in most cases, people go based on how you look, and they're not going to say, well, let me find out if you have a white parent first, right? A lot of times people will react just based on how you look, regardless of what your actual parents look like.
So you're saying, I'm glad you said that, then. So you're saying it kind of like Dr. Wellsen says that basically without somebody being able to prove you got one drop of black blood in you, if you mm-hmm. pass the skin, the paper bag or whatever, let's say you pass the white sheet test, nobody's really tripping long as you just fair-skinned and pale and white or close mm-hmm. as white you can get. That's kind of what you're summing up. Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah. I think one of the young men I interviewed for my YouTube series, he said, you know, a lot of times we talk about this genealogy pie chart. You see the commercials for Ancestry.com, and he made a very – it was humorous, but it's very true. Like, people are not going to say, let me see your Ancestry.com pie chart so I can really know who you are, right? People are not going to ask. They might assume, but they're not going to ask you to prove what your racial or ethnic background is. They're going to say, oh, she looks like a white person, I'm going to treat her like a white person. Or she clearly looks like a black person, I'm going to treat her like a black person. Or she looks biracial, I'm going to treat her the way I typically treat biracial people. Now, I'm not saying that that is fair treatment. Right? I'm not saying that that treatment is appropriate. And a lot of it is implicit, a lot of it is subconscious or unconscious. But most often when we're talking about colorism, and even with racism, like if you look white, then when you go in the store, the clerk is going to treat you the way you look to them, right? If you look black, the clerk in the store is going to treat you the way you look to them, or the person giving you an interview, right? So if you go into an interview and there's nothing on your application, nothing that you say during the interview to let them know that you're black, then they're going to go under the assumption based on what you look like. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you. Hey, Elliot, I want to tell you before I leave, you know John Henry Clark, you remember he called out Farrakhan like that. So I'm going to let it go. Thank y'all. Move my line.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ramon. You know, we're going to take a brief break. Listen, Ms. Webb, I'm glad you stayed a little overtime with us. we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I want to kind of focus in on some solutions, because you're in an environment where you are teaching our young people. And, well, I'll ask you some of those questions when we come back from a break.
Okay, thank you.
We still got some time, so if you want to participate in the discussion, you can do that by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals. nothing civilized. And when, and naturally, it was so negative until you, it was negative to you and me. And you and I began to hate it. We didn't want anybody to tell us anything about Africa, and much less call us an African. And in hating Africa and hating the African, we ended up even hating ourselves without even realizing it. Because you can't hate the roots of a tree and not hate the tree. You can't hate your origin and not end up hating yourself. You can't hate Africa and not hate yourself. And you show me one of these people over here who have been thoroughly brainwashed, who has a negative attitude toward Africa, and I'll show you one that has a negative attitude toward himself. You can't have a negative attitude toward yourself, a positive attitude toward yourself, and a negative attitude toward Africa at the same time. To the same degree that your attitude, that your understanding of an attitude toward Africa becomes positive, you'll find that your understanding of and your attitude toward yourself will also become positive. And this is what the white man knows.
I come here tonight and plead with you. Believe in yourself and believe that you're somebody. And as I said to the group last night, nobody else can do this for us. No document can do this for us. No Lincolnian Emancipation Proclamation can do this for us. No Kennisonian or Johnsonian Civil Rights Bill can do this for us. If the Negro is to be free, he must move down into the inner resources of his own soul and sign with the pen and ink of self-assertive manhood his own Emancipation Proclamation. Don't let anybody take your manhood. Be proud of our heritage. As somebody said earlier tonight, we don't have anything to be ashamed of. Somebody told a lie one day. They couched it in language. They made everything black, ugly, and evil. Look in your dictionary and see the synonyms of the word black. It's always something degrading and low and sinister. Look at the word white. It's always something pure, high, and clean. But I want to get the language right tonight. I want to get the language so right that everybody here will cry out, yes, I'm black, I'm proud of it, I'm black and beautiful.
Africa was dominated by the colonial powers, and by the colonial powers of Europe having complete control over Africa, they projected the image of Africa negatively. They projected Africa always in a negative light. Jungles, savages, cannibals, nothing civilized.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. A little technical issue there, but we're back, and we're back with our guest, PhD candidate for English, writer, educator, and advocate, and activist, founder of the website Colorism Healing. Sister Sarah L. Webb is with us this evening in conversation. And for the time we have left, you can still get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Ms. Webb,
yes.
Your work with children, and for first, when you do a lot of your talks and engagements, is it mainly with children, with adults, or it varies? It just across the spectrum.
It is definitely across the spectrum. Right now, I am still in the mindset of anybody who will let me talk to them about colorism, I will go and talk if I'm available, you know, and if I, you know, have access to the place where they are. I do try to
talk from places that I have experience with. So I talk a lot to teachers, for example, since I am a teacher and I taught high school. I've trained teachers, and I think that's important too. A lot of the work I try to do with is with people who can then pass that message on to other people, right? So teachers have access to way more students than I do, you know, counselors, coaches, parents, right? And, like, teach them the skills that they can then bring back to the children in their community. So, yeah, I'm definitely still of the mindset where if you really want to talk about colorism, I will go. I don't care how old you are. I really don't care what race you are either, right? Any gender, nationality. I'm trying to raise consciousness across the board about the issue.
Ms. Webb, the now, and I'm gonna tie this in with something that I wanted to question Richard about when he mentioned it on the program a couple of weeks ago. Richard took some children on a tour as a tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia, and it was a group of children. Richard, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. and the children were part of Jack and Jill.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, right. Jack and Jill historically was an organization that was based in colorism, similar to Boulé, where you had a brown bag test to even be a part of it. You correct me if I'm wrong, Richard.
Yeah, that's the thing. At one point, they did use the brown bag.
Now, I don't know whether that has changed because, but, you know, is this talked about among, because you have children still involved in Jack and Jill, is this thing talked about among the children? And that's a question before I kind of spin this off to Ms. Webb.
Now, in the tour, and it's interesting because I did four different, in my memory right now, four different Jack and Jill groups from different areas. So, specifically dealing with quote-unquote colorism, no. But it seems, you know, when you look at the parentage, they are, it doesn't have what we have, the stereotype image, you know what I mean, on one hand. And they are, the reason why they bring them to the museum is because they want them to be culturally and from what I get in the exchange, they want them to be historically centered as young leaders. But as far as the parents, you couldn't, the U color, you can go across the U color, and the children, you can go across the U color. But we haven't, I haven't specifically dealt with the colorism more than the leadership.
Okay. I was just wondering because I knew the historic connotation dealing with the organization Jack and Jill. But my question,
if I may, last week, it wasn't a Jack and Jill, it was a church. And one of the young females, because, you know, the image of one of the exhibits we call Black Pulp, and dealing with the images of dealing with Black images from 1916 to 2016. And so one of the images dealt with a image of a Black and white male and female as a picture. And the female, she was brought up about her being of mixed parentage. And in our discussion, which it was about eight of us, they're young and primarily young. In our discussion, she was dealing with the thing of her being of mixed parentage. And though she's Black, she still feels that she has some, she can get some benefit that other darker skinned people wouldn't be able to get. But, hopefully we elevated that. What I was trying to say is she was wrestling with whether she was in the middle. She's not white, she's not Black, but she's in the middle. And I had to, in our discussion, raise the point, but it's what you are identified as, not necessarily just being in the middle makes you, there is such thing as a middle. You know, that's, I guess, what I was trying to get across.
How old was she?
14.
Okay.
Yeah. And then others got into the discussion about it. Even one young man brought up about his grandparents being or one of the grandparents being of mixed race, and you know, the story that she told him, and he's trying to communicate it. So I see, and it goes to what you said, Sister Webb, this generation particular, and probably the last two, the X's and the Y's, excuse me, I'm not being provocative, I just can't remember all these different classifications. There's a different, trying to create a different understanding of coming out of mixed parentage, and where do they fit in?
Well, you know what, Richard, I just want to say this before I get to my question with Ms. Webb. I think that, you know, when our people are discussing that fitting in part, we got to realize in this society, they consider you black.
Right.
Whether you mixed parentage, one drop, you might be light skinned or light as I don't know what, they consider you black. So, you know, we just have to deal with it from that perspective.
And
some of our people looking for these little niches.
We got to that point. Elliot, when we got to that point, and Ms. Webb, Sister Webb, when we got to that point, and that was the point that was made eventually, she seen that. She acknowledged that. That's the point I'm making. You know, she acknowledged it, but without that discussion, without that catalyst, she wouldn't have had, as we were saying earlier, she wouldn't have had anybody to, you know, like that intergenerational and amongst your peers discussion to move it to where she can be able to see that in the end is we're all considered the same.
Ms. Webb, the question I want to kind of ask you was, in your work, do you find that certain areas of the country might be a little difficult to have this discussion than other areas? And I'm not saying that, you know, maybe certain areas might not be as conscious, or they might not. Have you found this discussion to be the same in all areas of this country where our people are?
So I think that's a great question. I think there are regional differences, and I'm going to say two differences that I mainly see. One, in certain areas of the country where there's less color diversity. So I'm in Louisiana, and Louisiana is infamous for what we call Creole culture, and, you know, a lot of the quadroons and octoroons that, you know, were free black in New Orleans and that kind of thing. So we very much are used to seeing differences in skin tone and, like, how that manifests, but, like, the issues that might bring up. But in other regions of the country, there's not that drastic difference. Or it's not as common, right? Like, there might be very, very fair skin in certain parts of the world, but for the most part, the black people in that city or that town might be dark to medium brown, right? Mm-hmm. So I noticed that in places like that, it might be harder for people to conceptualize, like, what colorism really means across the board. Another area where I find it's difficult to talk about actually is in the opposite direction, where there's a lot of diversity, a lot of cultural diversity. So a lot of times you go to larger cities like the Bay Area of California, where I spent a couple of years for my master's. There's so much cultural diversity there that it actually becomes hard to identify colorism, right? So you have people not necessarily say privileging light-skinned black women, but they might privilege Filipino women, or they might privilege Mexican women, or they might privilege white women, like are you know, other races of women. So that makes it, but it's still rooted in the fact that they want a certain hair texture and a certain skin tone, right? And so that complicates the issue when you throw in other ethnic groups, because at the end of the day, a lot of the people are still saying, oh, your hair is long and curly, or your eyes are hazel, but that person might be from Colombia or from Mexico or from Cuba or something like that. And so a lot of people in those towns or in those regions of the world that are very diverse also have a lot of times have the perception that because they're diverse that they're kind of past those issues. Like, oh, well, we don't have to worry about that because we're so diverse here. When in actuality, that actually hinders you from being able to recognize it a lot of times. So that's been my experience with talking to people from different parts of the U.S.
Another thing, too, and I guess part two to the question. Based on the documentary that was done by Bill Nunn, I think he was a partner in it a couple of years ago. Well, it might be more than a couple of years ago now, Dark Girls.
Mm-hmm. Bill Duke.
Yeah, Bill Duke. What did I say? Bill Nunn? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bill Nunn has passed away. He was, I think he was Spike Lee's protege. Okay, Bill Duke. Do you find that this is more prevalent among women, or they feel the brunt of it more? Is it black men? Is it equal? Talk about it, because I mean that topic can spin off into other, because you know, some black men feel abandoned by black, some black women feel abandoned by black men. You know, that black men want white women, or they want real fair skin. I'm not talking about light skinned black women. They want women that can almost pass for white, you know, and some women feel abandoned by a black man, and I guess vice versa. So do you find this problem, or this perceived problem, voiced more by women or men, or equal?
So I definitely think that it impacts women more,
okay,
because we live in a society where women are judged more on how we look than men are on how they look. Now, men are definitely judged on how they look, right? I'm not saying that that is not a thing. But you can. So, for example, and because I've been interviewing a lot of men, and I talked to him about this Biggie Smalls. So Biggie Smalls, the rapper, he has this one line where he says, "Heartthrob never, black and ugly as ever." So he's acknowledging the fact that as aesthetically, like, he is not considered beautiful by the world. But then he goes on to say, however, you know, I have fancy watches and a lot of cars, and I still get a lot of women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So because men, their value in society, and I'm not saying that this is a good system, right? But it is the system. Their value is less on how they look and more about how much money they make, or like how masculine they are, how powerful they are, right? Their status in society. Whereas women's value in our current social system is mostly on how we look. So because of that, colorism does have more of an impact in women's lives, tends to have more of an impact in women's lives. There are exceptions to that rule, of course. But then also, dark skin is associated with masculinity a lot. So a dark-skinned black man, even though people might not think he's the cute guy, they still give him credit for being tough, right? Oh, he's tough, he's rugged, or, you know, he'll be a good athlete or whatever. So because dark skin is seen as more masculine a lot of times, that's why you don't see as many dark-skinned men, you know, speaking the way that you did saw the women in that film, Dark Girls.
Okay.
So because dark-skinned women don't have the added benefit of saying, oh, well, at least my dark skin makes me masculine and tough, right? Because that's not supposed to be what women are. So I think that's one of the nuances around gender.
The talk, you know, you talked earlier in the beginning of our conversation about you dealing with a class of young people, children. And when you hear children give stories about how they don't feel as though that they're beautiful, how they think they're ugly, I know that pulls at your heart. Yeah. I mean, it would really be emotional for me to hear that, because, I mean, if children are saying this, they're not just saying it to you at school or at an auditorium setting. Evidently, they're telling this to someone at home. Or they might be hearing it at home.
Yeah. And I always feel like if it's to the point where you're saying it casually out loud, as if you would say the sky is blue, then the level of internalization is extremely deep.
Exactly.
A lot of times we might have negative thoughts, but we're like, oh, I can't say that, though. Right? But if you are so comfortable with these ideas that you're willing to say them, a lot of times they would be saying them in my presence as a dark-skinned woman, and they just would say it as though, hey, everybody feels like that. Of course, that's just normal. That's just what I'm supposed to think. So yeah, it's definitely heartbreaking. But continue.
No, I wanted you to speak to that issue. You know, how do you deal? I mean, because you've dealing with this subject, I'm quite sure you heard a lot of different. You might have heard it all. So how do you deal with that? How do you reach them? How do you Do you have personal sessions with them? Do you talk to them on a constant basis? I know you don't just give them a couple words and let them go on their way.
No. So it depends on my existing relationship with them.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes all I can do is give them a couple of words, depending on the context in which I hear these things. But for example, like if they're in my class, I always try to address it in the moment, right, and on the spot. As a teacher, you know, the bells are ringing, students are switching between classes, they might be taking exams, right? But I always encourage other teachers, and then I myself would try to say something immediately, but then follow up, right? So you can't always, like, pull them out of class or, you know, have an hour-long conversation with them on the spot. But I would say, hey, you know, actually, you are beautiful, you know, no matter what your skin color is, you are a beautiful dark-skinned person. Or if they are saying something negative, I would say, hey, you shouldn't judge people's character based on their skin tone, right? Like, you can't go use these stereotypes. You know, what if a white person said that about you, you know? So you can't then stereotype someone else just because they're darker, right? So I do try to address it in the moment and not just ignore it. But then as a teacher, I try to make it a teachable moment for all the students, because a lot of times it's a comment that multiple people have heard, right? So then it's not just about teaching that one student who said it, but then you have to kind of do damage control for all the other people who were exposed to that idea, right? All the other people who witnessed the bullying or who witnessed it, right? So then I have, you know, I incorporate it into my class. And this was when I was teaching high school specifically. You know, I would try to play videos or do activities and exercises with the whole class to try and get them to think critically, right? So I would try to get them to think critically about it. And I think it's important, too, to not preach to teachers, to teenagers specifically. You know, young kids, you can kind of, like, just tell them. But teenagers specifically, you know, I try not to, like, preach to them. So I do pose it more as, like, hey, well, think about this, right? I ask them questions to help them come to a different conclusion, right? So then it feels like they came up with the idea and not that I told them to feel some type of way. So I think that's very important too, is not just telling people what they should think, right? But helping them to practice the ability to discern for themselves, like, hey, that does feel wrong, you know, or that doesn't sound quite right. Like, what would I say if a white person had said I was lazy, right? But then I can't say someone else is lazy because of their skin tone, right? So that's how I try to address it. If I have limited access, so now that I'm not in the classroom as a full-time teacher, I might meet someone in the mall, right? So then I do small things, like I'll give them my information. I'll tell them how pretty they are, how beautiful they are, and then I'll give them my card and tell them, hey, you know, if you write, I have a writing contest. I would love for you to enter. So I just try to give them a line of connection if they want to, like, go home and take it further. Because you don't always have a way to continue the conversation after that. So I just try to come up with ways for them to follow up if they choose.
Okay.
If they're ready.
Do you think that the educational institution, especially public education institution, should be, like we're talking about African-American history or African history, should be required to address this issue in some kind of structural way?
Yeah, I think that to build it into the curriculum, I think is very important. I think because I have not come across a young student in teaching who has not seen or witnessed or personally experienced or perpetuated colorism, right? One of those things has happened to most African-American children, if not all. You know, I'm very cautious about saying all, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was all.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think any curriculum for African-American history or, you know, related fields, even just American history, honestly, it could be any any history class or sociology class, I would advocate for them including issues of colorism in the curriculum for people to think about critically, definitely.
Mm. Yeah, because I'm just one, you know, as you say that, and you're, you know, in the situation that you were in and dealing with young people, and I engage with them all the time, and I only have one image of an individual. I shouldn't say all the time, but in that volunteer status, I do engage with them, and I notice it's difficult to raise that because it does take some even in a historical context, it has so many dimensions of its own, you know, mm-hmm. and it has to be, as you say, it has to be, they have to be a part of the discussion more than just telling them what the right. event was or the individual was and even mention if they are, but to get them to bring out, you know, and that's why I'm raising about the curriculum thing. But one mm-hmm. thing I think is the reinforcement I see, you know, when we talk about this image production, mm-hmm. even at the daycare level, I see how the imagery is not a projection, a positive projection of the variety of images, colors mm-hmm. With that children are being exposed to that is outside of the family, outside of the home. Because you go to these, mm-hmm. some of these daycares, they have, if they don't have, what's that, Sesame Street images? Right. They got some other Dora mm-hmm. images in these, and these are young children that are getting these images about mm-hmm. their self-image, about their identity. And that's why I know that it's, I believe it's a bigger issue that we have yeah. to tackle.
I loved the sound clips that you played after the break of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Some of my favorite recordings by those two men. But the Malcolm X quote in particular is one that I came across as a youth, as a teenager, that even though I was already headed in that direction of, I went natural when I was 15, right? And so I was, you know, coming into my own consciousness. And so coming across that specific quote by Malcolm X where he talks about the European powers that controlled the images of Africa and made us hate Africa by depicting it as a land of savages. And they said, everything African is bad. And we didn't want to be associated with Africa, right? So anything to us that represented that negative place, such as our skin tone, our hair texture, we wanted to try to get away from that. And then he goes on to talk about how, like, you know, because our dark skin and our wide noses or our woolly hair to us symbolize that hatred for blackness, we then ended up hating ourselves. And so I think with education, knowing, like, actual African history, right, beyond Robinson Crusoe or, like, you know, these white made depictions of Africa is really, really important too. So I think even in curriculums, even before you get to like the specific issue of colorism, I think like curriculums need to address like the actual history of Africa so that students can stop saying like, oh no, I don't want to go to Africa. You know, they ain't got nothing in Africa. And, you know, I put up pictures of modern day Africa and I say, where is this in the world? Right. And my students would say, oh, that's Paris or that's New York. Why? Because they don't associate skyscrapers and bridges and infrastructure right. and wealth with the continent of Africa, right? And so just kind of reprogramming, like, you descend from greatness, right? You descend from a place that's not hateful, despite what European and white American media has made us believe, has reduced Africa to this one, like, pitiful thing that a lot of my students perceived it to be. So I think that's important too in terms of education and curriculum. Like Malcolm X was saying, is like helping the young people appreciate their African ancestry instead of trying to run from it.
Ms. Webb, before I kind of turn the floor over to you so you can let the listening audience know how they can read your articles if they want to mm-hmm. contact you for speaking engagements. One other question that's kind of related but a little off the topic. I don't mm-hmm. know whether you saw, it was a news story out a couple of weeks ago in New York City. Mm-hmm. And using it as a backdrop of, because I know that you said sometime you teach in a school setting, mm-hmm. that the majority of teachers that are interacting with black students are white women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In yeah. New York City, I think it was a school in Harlem. It was a black teacher that was teaching the Harlem Renaissance. And mm-hmm. she was told, I don't know whether you saw that article, that she was told by the school district to stop teaching about the Harlem Renaissance because, and the excuse they use is that she's an English teacher and she's not a social studies Ooh. Teacher, so she can't teach the Harlem Renaissance. Well, a lot of neighborhood activists got kind of behind her. to support her. If you Google it, you'll read that article. And I just wondered your feelings on this, because I hear you talking about things that you try to do in the classroom, and I'm wondering whether you're receiving any pushback in the district you're at.
I don't receive any pushback in my district. I'm just curious to know, like, how people found out, right? So it's not usually the district doesn't have time to, like, look and see what every teacher is teaching. So there might have been, like, a parent who complained or someone else complained in order for the district to even find out about that.
Okay.
So I would be curious to know how that happened. But I think a part of the problem is that districts, the people making that decision in the district, don't really understand the content, right? So some of the people making those decisions have never been teachers. And if they have been, they have never taught English or social studies. Because as a teacher, as an English teacher, I taught English in high school. I definitely taught the Harlem Renaissance. Why? Mm-hmm. Because if you're teaching literature, then you have people like Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, that's who you know.
It's kind of hard to teach those things without talking about the Harlem Renaissance.
It's kind of funny because that's what she said in the article.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. That's very unfortunate, but I hope enough people were able to come to her side and that is rectified.
And we have to keep in mind when we say this is a system that this is a deliberate construction, and the district, the school districts around the country that provides public education is set up to foster, to continue this, whether we call it colorism or the dominance of those who are white. And then the substructures within that, and the color, as we talked about earlier, whether it be a informal color caste system or class system, it's a part of the educational process. And so, you know, it don't even have to be somebody telling, just send somebody, one of the teachers there who's just a coworker mentioning, and the district saying that you're not supposed to do it. I mean, even to get Black history into these full history within the American textbook, how difficult that is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't difficult, if it was okay, it would be there. But that's something that they don't believe structurally, systemically, that we should have. And therefore, we don't.
Yep.
Until we push for it to make it happen. And what you're doing is pushing.
Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Ms. Webb, before we leave, give out any information, how the people can read your articles, how they can catch you on social media, how they can even reach you if they want you to bring you in for a speaking engagement. Go ahead. The floor is yours.
Yes. So you can find everything you need to know at colorismhealing.org. You can find my contact information if you want to reach me directly. You can find a link to my writing contest. The deadline for that is April 30th. It's open to everyone. You can find links to other resources like books and worksheets and things that I have. And you can find access to all my blog articles and my newest YouTube series where I interviewed several Black men about their perspectives and experiences with colorism as well. But also you can follow me on social media. I prefer Instagram. Instagram is my favorite platform, but I'm also on Facebook and Twitter at Colorism Healing. And I would love to hear from any person who's curious about learning more, just wants to say hi.
You know what? And I'll be in touch with you too, because I want you to submit some of your blogs and I can share them on the Time for an Awakening website.
All right. Great.
And thank you for being with us. And
thank you so much for having this topic of conversation and allowing me to participate in the convo.
Was needed. And we might be reaching out to you again in the future to come back on to talk about some more issues related to it, because this conversation needs to be had.
Yes.
I have to tell you, Sister Webb, now y'all going to make me have to learn how to do this Instagram. Every time I come on this program, y'all got some new stuff I'm supposed to learn how to do, Elliot. What is up with that?
I don't do Instagram either. I don't know. Thank you for being with us.
If you're on Facebook already, you can do Facebook as well.
Thank you for being with us. And
we'll talk to you
soon.
Bye.
We'll be right back.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? You realize that nobody's going to save black people but us. If you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
No, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you want on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our story.
Let's buy Black365.com.
Welcome back. The time for an awakening, and I want to thank our guest this evening. PhD candidate, English writer, educator, advocate, and activist, Ms. Sarah L. Webb was with us this evening. Richard, interesting yes. discussion we had with her.
Yes, I think we were continuing to unpack this whole thing of colorism and moving, trying to move beyond it, just by having Sister Webb in, and just bringing her experience and project to the table.
Yeah, and I like the way the discussion flowed, because the reality is, Richard, that these things have happened to our people, and mm-hmm. it was a strategic plan to destroy our people. It didn't work out as the authors of this plan, Europeans, really thought it would, but it did enough damage that we have to undo. But the only way we can undo the damage is talk about the origins of it, talk about what it has done to our people, and then devise some type of strategy to alleviate the pressure and correct the wrong. You can't deal with this issue if you want to bury your head in the sand and not talk about it. You just can't. That's foolish. We have to talk about it. We have to strategize around what we need to do in order to correct the situation. Nobody's going to do it. We can't, you know, waiting on white folks to correct the situation is part of the problem. That's part of why our people have been running in place, basically, for a number of years now. It's time to get off the treadmill. You know, the treadmill, you can run as fast as you want, but you ain't going nowhere. You're running in place.
You said you ain't going nowhere.
No.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, Elliot, out of discussion, it raises for me, and maybe I bring this preconceived notion, as much as colorism is a part of the programming, how much of our, and I don't know how big this our is or this we is, our lack of willingness to take control. You know, you play that clip by Martin Luther King, and he said, don't let no one take your manhood from you. Mm-hmm. But when we don't put a system in place to do what Sister Webb said as far as helping in the healing of this colorism, it's like someone taking our manhood, because it's our responsibility as a people, knowing, as you say, the history, to be able to put in place to protect what has been definitely wronged by us. And that wrong meaning created a condition in our own mental mind where we think that making their image, their likeness, our aspiration in everything we do. That's our responsibility to put a system in place to nullify one and produce and protect the other. And place the images that we have. We have the images, you know. We have the knowledge, as you say, you know. And when we don't do it, it's like somebody saying, you know, like we're saying, we don't feel man enough, woman enough, to go up against this and stop this from happening.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a work in progress, and it's nothing that can't be accomplished. You know, we can see the building blocks there. Mm-hmm. We can see the young and old people that are ready and willing to get started and to roll up their sleeves and get busy. The work is being done. I think that we just got to connect the dots, and more we try to utilize this program to showcase people that are mm-hmm. doing the work, similar to our guest tonight.
Right.
I mean, they're doing the work. She's doing the work, trying to, you know, and people are listening. And I, you know, I'm appreciative of the call that came out of Mississippi tonight.
Yes.
Sister had excellent questions that she put on the tape. And she was looking at it like, how can I be an ally? But, you know, she's already an ally. She's black like we are. We're all in the same boat. We don't have to look at it like she's part of the problem and she needs to correct. You know, we're all in this together. We just got to realize what has happened to us so we don't keep perpetrating these same behaviors and passing them down to our children.
And it is about power, and power is about our relationship with each other. So it's definitely, you know, as you said, you know, we're allies. We're born allies. It's when we decide that we're going to become, I'm told not to use the word collaborators anymore, but complicit in our own demise. You know, that's the, and somebody used someone like, what's that Supreme Court justice name?
Who, Clarence Thomas?
Thomas, right.
Well,
he's complicit in our own demise.
I'm going to tell you one thing, Richard. Now, somebody might have told you not to use the word collaborator, but I'm going to use it, because whenever you talk about people like Clarence Thomas and his others of his ilk out there, they're definitely collaborators.
Yes.
So, you know, you might, you can dress it up and say they're complicit.
You say, oh, now you call it dressing it up. Good. Well, and when they asked us, all of those mean the same thing in the end. They ain't working for our own best interest. And this color thing is not to our best interest, because it has us infighting. mm-hmm. even down to our family level. I mean, our immediate family level, you know, and to our children that haven't even created, as she said, that haven't even created the defense mechanism to understand why we are labeling them less than before they even get started.
I know it. That's the sad thing, to hear stories like that, you know, like, wow, you know, they're coming telling her that, and she, like she said, is rolling off their tongue, like, you know, mm-hmm. Like, what's wrong with this?
I mean, one of those clips in it that she, I believe is in, on our blog, it shows where, you know, that imagery of the child picking when it's asked, well, who's the smart one? She picks the white one. Who's the dumb one? She picks the dark one. Who's the pretty one? She picks the white one. Who's the ugly one? She picks the dark one. And then ask. And this is, that child couldn't have been no more 4 or 5 years old. So, you know, this is the urgency that we're dealing with. And, you know, as you said, this is why you're seeing people out there like Sister Webb, Sarah Webb, should say, and why we have to give them the kind of support, you know, in order to make it a more expansive. Because it's not an I thing, it's a we thing.
And, you know, the more and more, Richard, that we put forth these subjects, talk about these different things, showcase people that are doing something, that are moving in a positive direction towards some type of nation building or some mm-hmm. type of stability in our thinking, which to me is all a part of nation building.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we look at the other side of the spectrum, and I'll just mention this before we leave the air tonight, and look at all this stuff going on here, you find the conversation among some of our people saying, we need to get this guy out of here. We need to try to get a Democrat. We need to draft somebody to run against him. Like, it's your obligation to right this ship. If we see this thing sinking, then we need to start putting a lifeboat in the water and getting mm-hmm. away from it. And if you don't know how to make a lifeboat, then make one. Because mm-hmm. you can see this thing is busted apart at the seams. Get people mm-hmm. quitting in midstream, just to get no explanation. I quit and all this other stuff. He's flip-flopping on the gun stuff. He's having dinner and lunch with the heads of the NRA and then turn around and say that he wants gun control.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, all this type of erratic behavior by Europeans and this government, I'm not going to say Trump. I'm not limited it to Trump. Mm-hmm. All this erratic behavior by Europeans and this system that's been created of white supremacy and white hegemony is busting apart at the seams. It was created on evil basis, and anything created in evil, it might stand for a little while, but it's not going to stand. It's not going to be permanent. The thing is, what do we do? That's the question that's always going to be before our people. What do we do? If you don't know what to do, then start looking for other people that are doing something and join in with them. That's but don't be a hindrance. Yeah, that's so it. You know, we see these things happening, man, and sure, we can talk about them as a teachable moment to take a turn from Sister Webb, which she was on. It's a teachable moment for people that don't understand that this stuff is dissolving almost before our eyes. You know, sometimes he writes the ship, but then you can see things. And when I say writes the ship, I'm talking about this system. You know, things look like it was really coming apart during Bush's administration. They act like they was writing the ship during the Obama administration. He was only helping out big business. But now things is teetering and tottering again. See, this is not grading upward. It's grading downward.
You know, today I heard in one of the talk shows, they had a psychiatrist on, and he said 20% of the young people, 20% of the young people in America have mental problems. in talking about this gun thing. 20%. This is young people. And the reason that's so important, you know, is, as you say, this system creates not just the challenges that we see that we have to deal with for ourselves. It's creating challenges for them, and they're more violent. That's young people who picking up the gun, and they say they can't identify them. There's no mechanism to identify them. So not only do you got somebody, you know, at the top now who they saying is narcissistic and on and on and on, they saying they got another layer that's all strung out on painkillers and another layer that is crazy as hell. And you can't tell it. And they're young.
Yeah, but you know
when
what?
You say coming at the seams, coming apart at the seams, we better learn how to swim or create a lifeboat or figure out something.
Now, you mentioned, Richard, that they can't identify them, but if you notice, when a lot of this stuff was going on in the black community, and it's still going on, it was don't snitch, stop snitching, and all this other stuff, turn these people in. So now the shoe is on the other foot, because these white parents know that their children are not right, and it comes from the household, and it only leaks out after they do something crazy. Now, this one boy that just went into school and shot it up, killed 17 people. Now, all of a sudden, it's coming out that the authorities, it had been reported to authorities, the school had reported this boy was mentally unstable. His parents, the adopted ones, and I think the biological ones, said that the boy had problems.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these people know he had problems after the fact. Then where was the snitching? Why don't they turn these people in? They not interested in doing it until they do something irrational.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
a system that isn't about prevention, but about after the event.
Yeah, well, and the thing that makes it dangerous is that they have access to guns. They can go in Walmart, Dick's Sporting Goods, and all these places and be 18 years old and buy a gun over the counter. I don't know of no black young person, 17, 18, that can go in any of these stores, Walmart, Dick's, any of these places, and buy no gun over the counter. I don't know of any.
Mm-hmm.
And if they are, I wish they call somebody, write in, say their name. You know, it might be one or two individuals that might slip through the cracks. But, you know, these white young people are going in stores and able to buy guns. Legitimately. I ain't talking about buying somebody lift up a hood of a trunk. And pull out a gun and sell it to somebody in the street. Where they just file off the serial number and all that stuff. I'm talking about going in there and legitimately buy a gun with a background check and everything else.
And you know, you're getting me started, Ellie, because the thing that got me, too, was the point of in Florida, they had to vote whether what they was going to deal with the gun thing as far as putting more restrictions on ownership of guns or arming the teachers. And the legislators voted in favor of arming the teachers. Now, if they telling me that they got the 20% at a young age is a little bit off, and we know these adults, we gonna put guns in their hand just because they're teachers?
Oh, man. I mean, listen, I'm telling you, the irrational thing, this place is coming apart at the seams. It ain't even rational thought in what they're doing. It makes no sense. So, the onus is on us.
Right. And that's the most important part, that it's on us. And now is the time, you know, as we become awakened to actually realize the kind of relationships. And, you know, we had on Dr. Fox earlier, if we're addicted to light, it's time to deal with that addiction. And if colorism is one aspect of that addiction, that's a means that we have to be able to take ourselves through some, like anything else, in order to wean ourselves from it. And it's for our own survival as a people, as a person, as a being on this planet. Because this thing is global. When we say global white supremacy, we're, you know, it's a system that's global. It ain't just here. And it ain't even white people, because we can have black people, Indians, Mexicans, and whatever running this system that they put in place, keeping it going. And the irony is that this system was put in place to strip us, to kill us, or to benefit them.
Yeah.
When a system is made like that, that's what it does. It ain't personal. It's just business. You know?
Well, you know, before we leave, and I meant to say it last week, and I didn't. We're now broadcasting live in the UK. It just so happens that when we broadcast live in the UK, I think it's 2 o'clock in the morning. But at least we're broadcasting live. We do have listeners there, and I was contacted about the show going live there. So I guess some of the folks that work at night in the UK can still listen to the program when they come home. But we're broadcasting on FunSahara.com, FunSahara.co.uk. They have other programs on the stream, and if you go to their site, that's www.funsahara.co.uk. You'll see some of the programs that they have up there. I think look like they got your favorite guy up there, Richard, after he got booted off of TV One, Roland Martin.
Uh-oh.
Roland Martin does the broadcast. Well, we're on here now, and I meant to give out the number for any of the callers that want to call from the UK, but I'll give it out next week, and that way I can kind of start fresh, because they can be able to be part of the conversation also. It's a number that they can call, toll-free, and plus they can reach us on Skype, too. So there's different ways where they can reach out to us, but we're broadcasting live there, and they'll be part of the Time for Awakening family, so to speak.
Great.
Before we leave this evening, I just want to say I want you to tune in tomorrow morning, 11 to 1 in the afternoon, for African Perspectives with Brother Oshie. That's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. You know, I've more and more folks coming into the shop and mentioning about listening to Brother Oshie in the morning. I don't know whether he's listening, but he got some listeners here. Philadelphia love his program.
Great.
They've been coming and talking about it, about his morning talk program. There's nothing else on in the morning that they can listen to, so they listen to him. So I really thought that was great that they would come in and let me know that folks that know that, you know, that we do what we do on Time for Awakening. But you can catch it Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Wednesday. Sister POC is back with Revive. That's Wednesday evening, 8 to 10. On Thursday, Us Lifting Us, the Black Economic Empowerment Movement, is broadcasting on Thursday evening from 9 to 10. And then on Friday, Time for Awakening is back at 8 p.m. on Friday evenings. Saturday, SST, Saturday Sports Talk with Brother Troy Wilmore, is on Saturday morning from 10 to noon, and other programs were supposed to be starting. They were supposed to start last month, but technical issues. How am I forgetting? Monday evenings on Time for Awakening with Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed, and then right after, Buy Black 365 Connect at 8 a.m., at 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Monday evenings on Time for Awakening. Catch Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8. And Let's Buy Black 365 Connect from 8 to 9. That's tomorrow evening on Time for an Awakening. Richard, come up on another program. And we didn't hear from your buddy tonight, Richard, so you can get on him when he calls on Friday. Because he always try to flip the script. We can turn the tables on him.
I thought he would be in on this, but he's there.
Yeah. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Or you're watching your children playing after school. They seem to be so unaware. Oh, I know the thing that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of. And little Mary, she said she got to teach school. If we know, always say we know about the problem. To save the children.